Everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's August 21st, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Ostrom. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises, and we help teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help you launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery. So how do you go about it? Go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly and we'll talk about how we can help. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those of you on the recording, we host these calls live. So don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's meeting valuable, please share it with your team. Head over to youtube.com/cloudposse and find the recording there. So let's see, what do we have here in terms of announcements? Gonna get back into here. First one that was shared with me was this one here. And I am a little bit skeptical of the total severity of it, but I think it's interesting enough to bring it up and how it was orchestrated to show the kinds of attacks that are possible. But also, I think that if you are in, I mean, if you're doing open source seriously on GitHub, there are some things that you should have enabled that would have made this really not that effective to begin with. So in this write-up, and it's quite extensive, they show how if you created a fork of an open source repository that had Dependabot enabled, and in your fork, you created a branch, and in that branch, you maybe added some malicious file, and then you also modified in some way the Dependabot.yaml, it would trigger Dependabot to run, and it would open up a pull request against the target repository, not your fork. That seems odd to me to begin with. I haven't independently verified that, but that's, I think, what the assertion is here.
That's actually anytime you open up like a pull request from a fork, the default target is the upstream repo. So you even if you do it in Git in the GitHub UI, you have to explicitly like select your fork as the target if you want, because they think that you're trying to like submit a contribution to upstream. So that's why that happened just by default.
So that's interesting. That means that the default behavior in Dependabot was similar to the default behavior in the UI, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Got it. Okay. And then this would run in the target repository with the permissions of Dependabot. And they were able to show that with this, they had some elevated permissions in the scope of the Dependabot user. And they were even able to, here you can see, modify the PR description as part of it. The parts I'm not entirely clear about is that they are saying that it runs a workflow on GitHub. And I didn't believe that Dependabot runs any workflow on GitHub, but they show some like hidden workflow that runs, and I don't know where it is in the UI here. Show all workflows here. So something related to this. And they were able to modify, I guess, how that ran and use the privileges of Dependabot. Two things to point out. One is that they talk about Dependabot as just any GitHub app. I don't believe that is true. Dependabot was acquired by GitHub and has some native integrations, for example, into the GitHub UI. I'm not sure that characterizing it strictly as a GitHub app is a fair characterization of it, or if this is, possible with other GitHub apps. And then the other one is that if you are running workflows automatically on PRs from forks, you probably have some problems to begin with. So what we've had to do at Cloud Posse is disable all GitHub Actions from automatically running on any pull requests from forks without explicit enablement on a PR by PR basis by reviewers. This party was already crashed by the Bitcoin miners, last year or 2 years ago, whenever that was, because they discovered, hey, I can open up PRs against all these open source repos and mine Bitcoin. There were other annoyances like that related to kind of spam pull requests. All right, I'm going to pause there. Matt, do you have any more insights on this one since you were the one who shared it with me?
Not particularly, other than the one thing that they did point out in several of these is that many organizations have given special privileges to Dependabot. So they're basically using Dependabot to keep like their dependency chain up to
Yeah,
date.
that's true. Yeah,
So
yeah.
that they're auto merging PRs that are opened by Dependabot. And then they were able to exploit that as well if they found someone who was explicitly saying, like, I think right there on the screen on line 10, you can see that, like, if that github.actor equals Dependabot, then do X, Y, and Z. And I think that and if this one is actually showing like the best practice one where you're supposed to check the Dependabot metadata afterwards to make sure that the pull request is legitimately from Dependabot in your repo. Because like that's the whole thing is that if you don't check that it's the actual Dependabot in your repo, then you could essentially get like cross repo like attacks like happening. And that's what they were showing up above. So yeah, I mean I think this is I think to your point, like disabling any workflows from running from forks definitely does it, but in large open source projects, that's also a huge burden on maintainers to make that like to make that not make them have to go manually like run that. So but that's why a lot of very large open source projects just don't do that, or they have like they're temporarily disabled, but then someone runs them by chat ops or something. And then when they run them by chat ops, they still might not realize that, like, it still looks like it's, I mean, it still really is coming from Dependabot. So they don't really necessarily realize that it's a problem, at the end of the day. So anyway, yeah, not a ton to add other than that particular, a lot of people give Dependabot elevated permissions by default, in their repos.
Yeah, a really good point about that. That is true. Any questions on this one? All right, moving on. Next one was something I came across by accident. I was trying to look up one of the tools I posted on Office Hours recently in the last couple of months. That was a project called Helm. Her, I believe, which was a way of publishing Helm charts to ECR or any private repository. Maybe this wasn't it. What was it? That was called Helper. Yeah, this was the one we talked about previously. And that was kind of popular when we talked about it. One of the things that was nice that it added was built-in integration with like Trivy for scanning for vulnerabilities and misconfigurations. So anyways, this one that I was sharing here is a similar project. I don't know that it does any of the real-time scanning that you get with Helmper, but it's a pull-through proxy, which is the nice part, that caches it in a Docker registry. That way, if your upstreams go away, or the version you depend on goes away or is tampered in some way, you're not affected, because this is pulling it from ECR ultimately. I believe this supports third-party registries and is not a registry itself.
Yeah, I think it actually says to use it with Scopio, like to actually sync to sync charts to like your repo. I think if you search for Scopio, I saw it in there. Oh,
What's
it's like Skopeo, I think. Yeah,
Oh,
there
okay,
it
there we
is.
go. Got it. What is, I'm not actually familiar.
That's actually the thing we use in our GitHub Action that synchronizes multiple ECR repositories
Oh, I remember
together.
that now. Yeah, you
Yeah,
worked on that project. Yeah.
yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, Scopio is a cool utility. If you need to also replicate images into multiple registries, this is a tool for that.
Yeah, or like cross region, like for DR purposes. We had like one customer who was building all their images to a primary region, and then we basically just have like a GitHub Action that runs on a cron schedule to synchronize all images to a different region in case they have DR issues.
Yeah, makes sense. So this is doing this for Helm charts. All right. Let's see. Any questions on that before I move on? Let's see, what was this in the chat here? Nope, that was just e.ai spam. All right. Next, this was one also, Matt, I think you shared with me. Switzerland has required now that government software is published as open source. I know the UK has been doing similar things, maybe not to the same extent. Also, I wonder what the boundaries are for this, but in general, I think it's a pretty interesting idea, especially since we as taxpayers are funding this development.
Yeah, it's basically like if you read the more detail behind all of this, it's any custom development that is done for like the Swiss government, as well as there's a mandate now also to look at open source software as the first choice for anything that will be used inside the government agencies as well. So they're trying to reduce like black box, things essentially. So
It would
I
be
thought it
nice
was
if
pretty
it
interesting.
came with also how you say, a stipulation of supporting that open source and not just burdening the open source.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Be nice if they use that for voting machines.
Right. Yeah. Along those lines, I think, yeah, that's a double-edged sword. I mean, ultimately, that will lead to more secure and transparent voting. I think there's a lot of security through obscurity that these companies hope for otherwise.
There's been a few initiatives I remember over the years to try to get open source voting machines, and including from California. And what some of the commissioners were finding was that the night like or midnight before the voting was opened, there would be updates to the machines, and it's not transparent.
Yeah. All right, next
But yeah, this is good stuff.
next announcement. This is something that's near and dear to my heart, why I'm sharing it. I've been following this thread and all the spam updates for over a year or two now. But GitHub has commented on it now. And while it's not the answer I wanted to hear, it does at least provide an update to manage expectations. So, what is the feature? If you use GitHub Actions, especially in a monorepo, you will have a large sprawl of workflows. And those workflows, for example, let's go to one of these like app on CS. Here's an example of a lot of workflows in one folder, and it's overwhelming, but it doesn't need to be. A lot of these are reusable workflows and could just be, moved off into a subfolder because they're like includes. Unfortunately, that's not supported in GitHub Action workflows, is using any sort of subfolders here. So the issue tracking this is this 18.0.5.5, and GitHub said they're not going to work on it this year, maybe next year.
You should definitely reply with a comment of plus one in the body of the comment.
Yeah,
That would
everyone,
be good.
plus one, and you warm my heart every time you do it because I get an email from you via GitHub.
It'd be actually really nice if GitHub put a filter on their outbound emails for any that email that just complete like only contains plus one as as the body. Like that would be great. Yeah. I get so many of those.
It's this is just, and they go in waves, right? Because somebody at work finds this issue finally, and then they broadcast it in their team channel and say, "Hey, everyone, go plus one this." All right, next announcement is Carpenter. We've been using Carpenter, feels like, for a couple of years now. We were previously using Spot.io and their Blue Ocean controller, which was nice. But Carpenter was nice because you didn't have to pay a commission for using it, and you get a lot of the same benefits. Plus, Carpenter is much more configurable from a infrastructure as code perspective. Well, it's been in pre-1.0 status for a long time now, and anyone who understands Semver means that in pre-1.0, the interface is subject to change at any time in any minor release of, that free 1.0. It's the escape hatch that allows you to iterate quickly while having some semblance of versioning. Well, now it's 1.0. That means it should stabilize. We've certainly been bit by a lot of the minor updates that have been happening in Carpenter as they geared up for 1.0. Now, all I wish is that this came default and with the EKS control plane, and then you wouldn't really need to do much at all to get a EKS cluster online. And I think it would bring a little bit more parity with GKE if this was just built into EKS. Maybe now that it's 1.0, that's something we can hold our breath for. Anyone know more about that?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I would ask you regarding the Carpenter, if this is another product from Amazon like ECS Fargate, or this is another platform?
Oh no, so this is a controller. It's like another, it's an alternative autoscaler essentially for Kubernetes that was developed by Amazon for the from the ground up. It's optional and you use it together with EKS. So it's something that you deploy on top of EKS to control how the cluster scales the node pools. And it makes it easier to have lots of different types of node pools with spot instances or on demand with different profiles of it, types of instances, how you can control how it scales, when it scales.
Yeah, it's like a controller plate.
Say that last part one more time. It's like a controller, but
Controller plate for Kubernetes EKS.
yeah, well, I mean, control plane has a very specific meaning in Kubernetes. But yeah, this should be part of like Amazon's distribution of its control plane for Kubernetes. but it's not yet. It's a separate thing you install. I don't even, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I don't even believe that Carpenter is available as an add-on in EKS either. So
I don't think so.
add-ons are a Amazon convention for Kubernetes, for EKS, that ships pre-baked templates, if you will, or charts almost, for EKS, but Carpenter is not one of those, I think. All right. Next announcement is,
Although,
yeah, go on.
just so I was just going to say, just to be, someone could do that because you can, there are, I forget what the program is called, but there's a way to basically have third parties like to publish add-ons essentially so that you can do that as well from ISV program. That's what I was trying to think of. So there's an actual way for them to publish that. Although, they are Amazon, so I guess if they haven't done it, like, yeah, maybe they won't do it, but I don't know why that,
I
I don't
believe
know
those
why
were
it
announced.
isn't.
I believe I heard some of the chatter from last year's reInvent that this was something that was planned eventually, that the Carpenter was going to be baked in to EKS, but that was the last I heard. That was just chatter. I think there's some GitHub issue though, talking more about that, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, and I just pulled up the docs real quick. It is definitely not one of the available ones now. So this I'll drop the link into the chat of all the available add-ons.
Also, I think there might be a question in the chat. I'll read that closer once we get through the announcements here shortly.
It wasn't a question. It was just a someone expressing their gratitude for us open sourcing the RefArch docs.
Oh, well, thank you so much for recognizing that. We appreciate that. All right. Let's see here. Amazon ads. Yeah, so this was one that caught my attention this morning. It's nice. It's just one of the 10,000 ways I wish error messages were improved in AWS. Let's see here. Why can't I expand this here? So Amazon S3 adds additional context to the 403 access denied error messages when those requests are made within the same AWS account. So, for security reasons, error messages are often very opaque and you don't quite understand what the message is. But at least when you're making that request within the same account, they are now revealing some more information about what led to that request getting a 403, reducing probably some large percentage of support requests in AWS. And that's why I'm guessing they made this change. I'd like to see this. I just wish there was some other way to make IAM easier like this by understanding which policy was in effect at the time you made that request. I know there's IAM Access Analyzer, which is great as well. Admittedly, that's not as easy as just looking at the response code you get back telling you such and such happened, but you got to balance security, I guess. Matt, thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, this is definitely like, this is definitely a step in the right direction. I think that the thing that I find the most frustrating is that CloudTrails, like CloudTrail logs and things like that, which definitely like show the show like access denied messages, do not do a great job of telling you like why something was denied or the specific policy that denied it or the specific policy that was in effect. And that's like within your own AWS account, calling your own AWS resources. So I think that logging should definitely be improved for sure. I think the problem is that the number of ways that you can grant access to AWS resources varies so greatly that that would be a massive change on their side to calculate all of that on like every request, basically. And
Yes.
I think that's the problem, right? Is that they need to do something that also scales like within their service and across services and all of that. But not that I want to make excuses for them, but it's not an easy problem to solve. They I think that they this is I use the analogy a lot. I know you've heard me say it internally, but like when you're kicking a ball down a hill, you kind of get one shot to kick it straight. And if you kick it straight in the beginning, it usually continues to roll pretty straight down the hill. But if you kick it at, a 10 degree angle, by the time you're, three quarters of the way down the hill, it's at like 180 degree angle or something by that point. And I feel like that's what happened with IAM, is that like they didn't really think it through at the greatest scale when they first kind of rolled it out, and they just kept bolting on and bolting on and bolting on and bolting on to this thing, and it's gotten so complicated over time that it's really hard for them to rein it in and fix it and give us the proper tools around it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my least favorite thing about AWS for sure. So.
Yeah. Same. All right. Next one was just one of the few updates I've seen recently related to, hey, what's going on? Didn't IBM acquire HashiCorp? What's going on there? So here was some update that caught my attention concerning some of the regulatory scrutiny that they're going through. This is not an official account. This was just some comments made by antitrust attorneys and a consultant about what might be going on right now with this transaction. All in all, pretty boring update. I guess it serves more as a reminder that A, it's not yet set in stone. Thanks.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that was interesting from there is if you open the link back up there's a couple of other links that show you that like the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, actually had like formal requests about the acquisition. So it isn't just like speculation that the government is looking into this from like an antitrust perspective. There are actual like government requests to review the merger before it happened. So, yeah. Maybe I had to Google to find. I think there's two like actual requests that came from the FTC around it. So.
Got it. Yeah, I didn't have a chance to read that one closer. And last one was just a ThoughtWorks update that OpenTofu has made it onto the ThoughtWorks technology radar, which has been around for quite some time and is a great place to at least kind of get a gauge on all the tech out there we're leveraging. The usual what's the word I'm looking for? The usual concerns are raised about its long-term viability and support, but and compatibility with HashiCorp's version are the risks to consider. All right, that's it. Any announcements that anyone else has? And yeah, I was just gonna read the testimonial out loud here. Thanks, Chris, for saying that. I just came here today to thank Cloud Posse for releasing your documentation of the reference architecture I'm learning about multi-account environments right now, and this is a wonderful starting point to learn about how to manage multi-account environment with a GitOps forward approach. I became aware of Cloud Posse shortly after learning the basics of Terraform, and I've learned so much. So yeah, thanks again, Chris. I appreciate it. And if anyone else isn't aware, we did bring it up last week on Office Hours. We did publish all of our previously closed source documentation around our reference architecture publicly. And another nice thing that we did this week was, if I can find an example of it here quickly, is we published also now the list of commands. Previously, we only showed the workflow to run. Now it shows also the commands that would be run by that workflow. So you can, it's a little bit less opaque. The raw configurations themselves of the architecture, for example, the contents of this file are available to anyone who goes through the quick start and does a GitHub sponsorship of Cloud Posse. We have that under here. So you go to choose your path, quick start, sponsor Cloud Posse. And yeah, we'll send you all the configs. If you do that, review your design decisions and make sure everything is sane before sending you on your way. I see one person has their hand up. Can I, yeah.
Hey, Eric.
Hey there.
I want to share a blog post that I have wrote about transforming an AWS architecture into an open source one. I talked about it 2 weeks ago, I think. So I share the link. I'll be curious if you give me your opinion on it.
Oh, okay, got it. Right. Yeah, let's see here. I admit I vaguely transform. Yeah, I don't know if I fully remember this. So yeah, let's see here. Architecture to open source. Okay, transform AWS exam generator architecture to open source, part one. Oh, I remember this. You were looking to take this really complex architecture and convert it into Terraform as a learning exercise. Was that right?
Yeah, not Terraform, but it was like Kubernetes and Helm charts. I was
Okay.
like using Helm file on that to
Yeah.
deploy. Yeah. So I wanted to share, I wrote a blog about it. It's about five posts, five articles.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you ultimately got it all running?
Yeah. There is a demo on it. There is a video showing, yeah. Showing the majority of the functionality.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, thanks for following up on that and adding the closure. Anyone else who wants to take a look at that, the link he posted is in the Zoom chat.
Thanks.
All right. See here. Is there anything else that was the add-ons? Yeah. All right. Well, let's transition to Q&A then. Any questions we can get answered today?
So, I saw a new security edit for Kubernetes service accounts on EKS, and I was curious what people thought about it. So one, they had this IAM for IAM roles for service account, which is I'm familiar with that one, but they added a new one recently,
Yeah.
and I
Pod
was kind of curious
identities.
about that. It looked to me like what AKS had with Azure Active Directory, where they had a pod identity for Azure Active Directory, and then later they're trying to use something similar to Google's what do they call that, work group identity or something like that, which seems similar to the IAM for Kubernetes services using like OIDC provider or whatever like that. So I was curious what people thought of this new model, if it's better or if it's a step back. Like Amazon's documentation is kind of saying, well, for this one, use this way, and for this one, use this way. So it's a bit kind of chaotic at the moment. or not so consistent. Just
This
wanted
was
to trade off, if that makes sense.
pod identity versus Ursa. Yeah,
Yeah.
Matt, you had looked into this, I thought, or was that someone else? Okay, do you want
No,
to
yeah.
take on it?
We both looked at it. Yeah, I mean, I think that the I think there's no doubt that if pod identities had existed from the beginning, this would be like the de facto way that people would want to do it. I mean, at the end of the day, this is the equivalent of being able to use like your EC2 like role instance ARN
Be secure.
to do things. So, I mean, this will essentially give you this will essentially just give you the ability for any role or any pod to have its own role, and you can assign permissions to it directly instead of needing to create specialty service accounts and then assigning those to certain groups of servers or containers, I should say, or pods out there. So I don't know. I think personally, this is the direction that AWS is going to go in the future. I think it's I think, well, there, I mean, here's on the screen. I don't have to go through them all, but there's a lot of the kind of the benefits. And honestly, I think like Ursa is really complicated for a lot of people to set up and manage and not accidentally grant privileges that you didn't mean to. And EKS pod identities like really simplifies the whole process at the end of the day.
I
And
think
just
our conclusion, I remember, for our reference architecture was since we had invested in simplifying and implementing support for Ursa, there was diminishing value in supporting pod identities relative to the
yeah.
effort of mixing everything up. Yeah.
Well, and I think, yeah, there's also a fair amount of work to do to migrate from one to the other, especially in reusable like infrastructure components like we have in our reference architecture, for sure. But the one of the things that I noticed, it now appears on the list I just posted a couple of minutes ago. It's actually one of the add-ons available now. Is to enable pod identities out of the box, basically with an add-on.
I didn't realize it needed to be enabled as such, like even with an add-on, that it would be native to the control plane. Would have been my
No,
assumption. Got
it's
it.
not. Yeah.
And then I was wondering on top, like a follow-on question is that if you were interested, the OIDC provider provides an opportunity, though complex, to do cross-cloud type credentials. So for example, I saw one where a bank wrote some type of operator. It was GKE to AWS, but there's no reason you can't do AWS to GKE. I mean, the vice versa. But where they had, like, say, maybe like an S3 bucket that was accessible by a GKE cluster, and they'd use OIDC provider to get access, and then they'd have an operator that would refresh the token under the hood so that it would have continued access to that specific resource and have it narrowed down to the Kubernetes service account on GKE. So they were somehow using workload identity, but with OIDC provider from AWS or something like that for that resource or something to that
Yeah,
degree.
I
Have
mean,
fuzzy on it.
yeah, the reason that the OIDC provider there is there usually is because what you're actually doing is you're essentially exchanging your AWS credentials, like your IAM role credentials for a Kubernetes service token that you can then use to run like things on the Kubernetes cluster and vice versa, where you're exchanging your Kubernetes service role tokens for actual like access to be able to assume IAM roles directly. Whoa, that freaked my eyes out. Your screen just went completely like blurry on my side.
Oh, weird.
I
Still
don't
that way, or
yeah. Yeah, I don't know why
yeah,
that happened,
still.
but
Oh, I see why. There we go.
That's much better. It was like a weird, like optical illusion in front of me. But yeah, in any case, you by introducing any kind of OIDC provider, obviously you can do some interesting things. But that also gets into an area where, you know, one small misconfiguration means you've just given access to a bunch of things that you know, you didn't mean to. So always be extra careful and test, you know, when you're playing with those kind of, you know, advanced scenarios, I would say.
So, like Uncle Ben, with greater power comes greater responsibility.
Yeah, for sure.
Any other questions we can get to today? So this is totally open-ended. We have no prepared questions here. So if you have anything that you've been working on, you're stuck, or have thoughts on, this is a great time to ask.
Well, I had I think it's DevOps Central or something like that, a Twitter group, recently promoted one of my blogs that I was really excited about. I had one called Pets versus Cattle.
Okay. Do you want to share the link to that one?
Sure, yeah, that seems to be pretty popular.
Were you narrowing that down in some particular way?
Well, what it was back in the day, I started like in the as far as cloud automation, I started on Puppet, and then went through different platforms and cloud to Kubernetes. And so one of the terms going around around the Puppet community and DevOps was pets versus cattle. So managing servers as lovable pets, or a web server farm as web 0123 as cattle. And so they had an article, they had a lot of writing or ideas or presentations. So I kind of scooped up what was around that type of ideology and then put it together as pets versus cattle.
I was really bummed when they renamed pet sets to stateful sets in Kubernetes. I thought it was appropriate.
Yeah, so I'll put my article there. And that's chat. Yeah, this is my article that I had. Read AI meeting notes. There's not a meeting.
Oh yeah, sometimes the two in the Zoom chat
Sure.
defaults to one of the other participants or like one of the bots. You just got to
Yeah.
change to meeting group chat.
Yeah,
Yeah.
for me now, every week it defaults to whoever the first like person into the group, into the chat was.
Oh, maybe that's the heuristic. Let's see here.
And I think what it is because when those AI bots join, they DM you to tell you that they've joined the meeting, and then by default it thinks you want to reply to them since someone just like DM'd you, so it leaves you in that context.
Yeah, it's become kind of bot warfare. We track in terms of our analytics the number of bots versus humans in office hours, and it's like we get 5 to 7 bots per week attending. Yeah.
So, do you mean that the five or six of the participants are currently bots?
Yeah, exactly. They show up as just
Wow.
people,
That's
yeah.
weird.
So people are basically sending their bots to attend instead of themselves. To be
That
fair, it's just the default setting that the AI software uses for viral kind of spread.
I am actually a bot.
Well, I know work makes you feel like that sometime.
Hey, Michael, I see you raise your hand.
Yeah, indeed. I guess 2 points. The first one, I'm guilty for sending a bot to this meeting,
But you said
because
you bailed us out. You bailed us out. That was a good one.
Yeah, no doubt. I can't always make it, but I like to participate in pseudo real time if I can. So I do send a bot. It captures the video and audio, and that was able to come in handy, what, a couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago, when Zoom kind of botched the recording on this side.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, my other point was I'm doing a series of talks for some folks on LinkedIn. And coming up this week, we're talking about CI/CD security. So I was just like reaching out to this particular group, and I was wondering, I mean, I've got some topics that I want to hit on, but before I share those, I was just wondering, like, how do you keep your CI/CD pipelines secure? Like, what are some of the practices that you implement out of the gate for your CI/CD pipelines?
Yeah, that's a good one. And I mean, I think it's important to, well, I mean, it's a very broad topic unless you narrow the scope. So, like, if we're talking about GitHub Actions, there's some very specific things you should do about securing those workflows. And that's going to be different from
Yep.
Jenkins and so forth. Are you talking about specifically GitHub Actions or more generally?
Well, very general to begin with, because usually what I do is like kind of approach the topic from a very general idea of like, hey, this is the thing and this is why it's important. And then I look at maybe one or two very, very specific use cases. Because like you said, the field is broad and wide and deep, so you can't cover everything in say like 30 or 40 minutes. But if you just wanted to say like, hey, here's a few things that you should know about or hit on, then yeah, I'll bring those up. And then I'll say, okay, of those things, today we're going to dive deep into this particular one, or here's a paper that you can read or a lab that you can go through or whatever case, something like that.
Yeah, no, a lot of thoughts on this, and I'm not sure if I can collect them all at the same time. But for GitHub Actions, there's a lot of things that I think companies don't fully or choose maybe not to go deeper on to fully understand and are setting themselves up for problems. So, most companies by and large use GitHub for Teams, which I didn't realize how much it was really a team product. And what do I mean by that? So in Teams, everyone's an admin. We want to, Scout's honor. We follow a certain practice to merge pull requests, and we can enable branch protections and so forth. But workflows can run on any branch and access anything that's a secret. So in that sense, secrets are not, there's not a modicum of security around secrets in a team environment using GitHub for Teams. Your pull requests and your pull request workflows, let's say you're implementing GitOps with GitHub Actions, you're using maybe GitHub OIDC to assume roles in AWS. So that's a step up. I mean, a lot of companies are using secrets, and I just explained that those secrets are not even secret. So let's say you're using GitHub OIDC. If that GitHub OIDC principle is not locked down to the branch of the repository, anyone that can create a branch in that repository has full access to whatever permissions of that GitHub OIDC integration. That's like giving any developer administrative access, they can open a branch or PR. So using pull request target is one of the mitigations for that instead of using pull request events. But when you start using pull request target, it's really annoying to develop workflows and pipelines because you got to merge it into main in order to even test it that it works. Or you got to change your default temporarily to your branch. Which require which means you're oh it's only for GitHub admins of that repo anyways.
Yeah, or use Act if it's one of the things that you can run in Act.
Yeah, and then
Yeah.
there's ACT, right?
Yeah.
But ACT, I mean, yeah, it's probably come a lot
It's
further.
gotten better. Yeah.
But one of the problems with ACT is you can frequently come up with workflows that work in ACT that don't work in GitHub Actions, vice versa. You
Or
can
vice versa,
yeah.
especially things that use like the cache and stuff like that. They break in ACT. Michael, I was actually going to write a blog post on this. I just posted it in the chat. I gave you my outline, my that I
Yeah.
never wrote the blog post on. So if you feel like stealing any of that, feel free. That's it's open for you. So
Yeah,
that
indeed.
was those were kind of some ideas of like the topics that I thought were very important to address in CI/CD. So.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for this. And I will pick up a couple. Some that overlap with the very short list that I had was like securing the CI/CD environment, limiting access control, protecting secret. Like that top three basically are some of the main ones that I wanted to cover. And to your point, Eric, yeah, I thought about I mean a couple of the points that you mentioned. Number one, like if you're in a team environment and you accept that PR from somebody who is not part of your team, and I think this is one of your points. It was like maybe a Slack discussion some while back about accepting PRs from people who aren't a part of your team, but then once their PR is accepted, they somehow kind of become part of your team or something like that. Like maybe their PRs aren't subject to review, or I forget what the case is, but anyway, their PR runs have access to your secrets and in your pipelines.
Well,
So
yeah,
that's
in GitHub for Teams, if you have write access to the repo,
there it is. Yep.
yeah, if you have write access to the repo, so we're not talking open source at this point because generally contributors, unless they're part of the project itself, don't have that. And we're not talking about write access to the fork. We're talking about write access to the target of that fork, so to say. Any branch has access to the secrets. And the only way to fix that is, well, you don't use secrets, or B, you use GitHub Enterprise. So GitHub Enterprise adds the construct of environments and protection rules for environments that restrict those to specific branches. And that's the way you get security. So this was kind of just the epiphany I had in the past year and realizing that you can't really implement secure CI/CD on GitHub without Enterprise. And that's why you have to pay for it.
Yeah. And well, no, I was just gonna say real quick, the other point was the tokens. And I'm guilty of this because I've taught people how to use GitHub Actions, Jenkins, whatever, whatever. And whenever they're interacting with AWS, for example, I say, create your IAM user, generate some tokens and store those tokens as secrets in your, framework or whatever you're doing, when really it should be OIDC, for a better security stance. So that was another thing that I was going to cover, just mainly for my benefit, because I need to start leaning more on that approach as opposed to using, long-lived tokens, which is a, definitely becoming a bad practice.
For sure. The other thing I was going to say is that on the list that I provided, that I feel like I've seen no one who does a really good job of this is like auditing and logging and monitoring of the pipelines themselves. Like, everyone just kind of does it, and whatever the GitHub UI says is what it says, but there isn't any kind of like correlation and centralized logging, and whatever, like automated rules that are looking at, things that look suspicious in CI, like, because a lot of the things that we've talked about could be picked up if we had a good like SIEM tool around like CI/CD, in particular. So, I think that that's like a that's a, an area to look for to improve. And then nine is the other really good ones, just like zero trust. Like, don't trust that like anything coming in or out of your pipeline isn't or hasn't been compromised. And if you try to think of it like that way, you'll start to be cynical, and you'll start to find ways to make it more secure, like through every step of the process.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that because after investigating this a lot, it's changed.